Hi, this is Haley Palumbo with Unknown America on 90.7 FM WGXC ACRA. This week is going to be a bit different. I have some irregularities in my schedule this week that are preventing me from writing an episode. So the two episodes I'm going to play for you, the first one is called Homer and Langley, and it is about the Collier brothers, who are New York City's first really widely documented hoarders from the 1900s. Really, really fascinating story. And then I'm going to play my episode about Vishnu Springs, which is a failed health resort and spa in the middle of the woods, downstate, kind of central downstate Illinois. So I hope you like the stories, and I will see you next week with an episode on parody musician Tom Lehrer. Thank you.
In all images, and there are many, the Collier brownstone looks like a tomb. 120 tons of trash, phone books, instruments, chairs, no telephone, no doorbell, windows clad in iron bars. It was a library of babble of garbage. Whenever you turned a corner or opened a door, you came across a new chaos of refuse written in a language you didn't know existed. In a notorious photograph, you see a police officer hung precariously onto the side of the building, attempting to access a room from the window. He was looking for a body. Herman Livingston Collier was born in 1857. He was a gynecologist who worked at Bellevue Hospital. Herman was an eccentric in the truest sense of the word. He paddled down the East River in a canoe to a hospital on Blackwell Island, where he frequently picked up shifts. At the end of the day, he would paddle back, often in the middle of the night, under the cover of an ink-black New York sky. Herman wed his first cousin, Susie Gage Frost Collier, in a simple ceremony. Susie was a former opera singer who was 1 year older than Herman. Together, they birthed a child who died at 4 months, and then they bore two sons. Homer and Langley were both brilliant and unusual. Homer was accepted into college at age 14, earning his bachelor's degree at the age of 20. Langley was an accomplished concert pianist who started at a very young age. In 1909, the family of four moved into a brownstone at 2078 Fifth Avenue. In 1919, Herman and Susie separated. Homer and Langley stayed with their mother in the brownstone, living with her until she passed away in 1929, leaving both parents dead. When Herman died, he left a tremendous collection of medical supplies and furniture that the brothers had left to the significantly smaller brownstone, creating a very difficult-to-navigate maze of clutter that their mother lived alongside of until she died. For 4 years, things continued as normal. The brothers left the house on a regular basis to socialize and work. Homer worked in law and Langley sold pianos. They also both taught Sunday school. They bought a brownstone across the street with the intention of converting it into an apartment building. Life was normal for a while, but then things started changing. The dark time in the brothers' lives could have been incited by a series of events, such as the Great Depression causing a series of changes that shattered the former prosperity of the beautiful neighborhood. The most obvious event is in 1932, when Homer suffered a stroke and ocular hemorrhages, which caused him to lose his sight and his job. The brothers hauled in trash and broken furniture from the street, so much of it that their dwelling turned into a maze and they slept in nests amidst the incomprehensible mass of clutter. Eventually, Langley quit his job to take care of his brother full-time, imposing bizarre folk remedies on him inspired by the growing darkness in his brain. He fed Homer hundreds of oranges a week, peanut butter, and loaves of black bread, convinced that this would cure his blindness. He would play Homer beautiful sonatas on his piano and read him works of classic literature. Before long, Homer developed rheumatism, a disorder which left him almost entirely paralyzed. Langley placed him in a velvet lounge chair that he never moved from again and would eventually die in. He refused any form of medical help. Homer, his only companion, incapacitated, Langley's mental state rapidly began to deteriorate. He no longer left the house before midnight, and on his long treks across New York City, with him he would bring back even more junk. Old phone books, statuettes, unused but ruined instruments, tin cans, empty bottles, dishes, books, fabric, and big stacks of newspapers. He said that he was storing them for Homer to enjoy when he eventually regained his sight. As opposed to paying bills, dreading the interaction that would bring, Langley allegedly jerry-rigged a Model T that was owned by the family as a source of power for the house. The brothers used a small kerosene heater to heat the home and got all water from pumps outside. This, combined with the growing mountains of trash and junk that spilled out of the house and into the street, drew the attention of incredulous, concerned, and annoyed neighbors. The brothers gradually gained notoriety in their neighborhood, and the more rumors that spread about them, the deeper they slipped into madness. An article was written about them in the New York Times, claiming they had turned down an offer of $125,000 for the brownstone. This insinuated that their home was full of treasure. Langley again exercised his extensive knowledge of engineering, constructing elaborate booby traps from the junk in the house to keep individuals from the neighborhood out, after children threw stones through the front windows, and burglars, enticed by the New York Times article claiming that the brownstone contained valuable riches, attempted to break in. Langley would walk for 7 hours out of city limits for loaves of bread, often not returning home until 4 or 5 in the morning, just before commuters would exit their brownstones and head to their jobs. Most days were spent with Homer, on a stomach full of 20 oranges, black bread, and peanut butter, contorted in his velvet chair while his brother built his traps that would crush any intruder under an avalanche of rotten encyclopedias and newspapers. After a period of prolonged silence from the brothers, an anonymous tipster reported a nauseating smell which incited a welfare check by the police. They were used to showing up at the Collier residence due to repeated complaints by neighbors. Once they were summoned after an attempt to evict the brothers was carried out and the brothers refused to go. They only left when Langley wordlessly wrote a check for almost $7,000, paying off the entire mortgage in a single payment. After that event, the police were generally met with a flung open door and a furious Langley demanding that they leave. This time, though, they were met with nothing at all. They decided that they needed to enter the residence. The lack of greeting from Langley, combined with the powerful smell of rot, was enough to arouse concern. Amid the maze of trash, which they spent hours wandering, miraculously triggering none of Langley's booby traps, they found the corpse of Homer. Homer's contorted body sat rotting away in his velvet chair in an alcove. Langley was nowhere to be found. This launched a multi-state manhunt, officers assuming that he was the anonymous tipster and had murdered his brother. Anonymous tips claimed they saw Langley on a bus to New Jersey, wandering the boardwalk or in bars. None of these tips were true. Turned out the officers were looking too far. Langley was found 1 month later by the police after an extensive cleanup effort, a mere 10 feet from his brother. He was crushed under his own trap. Having been paralyzed, Homer had no recourse but to sit idly as his brother suffocated. Having no caretaker to feed him, an autopsy revealed that he starved to death days later. The brownstone was painstakingly cleared out and demolished. The police found plaster busts, pinup photos from the 1900s, hundreds of yards of silk, glass chandeliers, bowling balls, hope chests, a sawhorse, old food, baby carriages, rusted bicycles, potato peelers, rusty bed springs, more than 25,000 books, human organs in jars, a clavichord, 14 pianos, bugles, violins, accordions, a gramophone, clocks, a massive collection of guns, and countless bundles of newspapers and magazines. The brothers' less valuable possessions were discarded or sold in a macabre auction. The estate in total was worth about $99,000, which today would be roughly $2 million. The estate, jewelry, securities, and cash was divided amongst 56 relatives. Some of the items were displayed in a dime museum, including the velvet chair in which Homer had died. The chair passed through the hands of collectors upon being removed from exhibition in 1956. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Haley Palumbo, and this is Unknown America, a show about figures and events and places and little pockets of time unique to America that often fall under the radar. Near the dawn of the 20th century, a man named Darius Hicks saw a business opportunity that was decidedly quite modern, swindling people on the basis of New Age healing. It was lucrative, to be sure, but the beginning of the end was marked by a sudden death that cast a pall over the whole thing and would result in the beginning of a slow erosion and rebirth that took 80 years. This is the story of the ruined Illinois resort town, Vishnu Springs. In the late 1800s, a man called Ebenezer Hicks and his family moved from Ohio to McDonough County in Illinois. A wealthy man, he purchased many parcels of land in McDonough and Hyer County, which eventually totaled 5,000 acres. He was aware that mineral springs existed on some of the parcels, but did not show much of an interest in it. However, a man named Dr. J.W. Aiken did. On that basis, Ebenezer Hicks rented the land to him, and Aiken began promoting the springs for their healing qualities. To understand this story, you will need a primer in a New Age healing movement that took place not in California in the 60s, but the Midwest in the late 1800s. Groups from all over the country in numbers as high as 1 to 2,000 came in droves, hoping to stave off the illness of the day by consuming a great deal of mineral water that flowed through the area's many streams. The people hoped to liberate themselves from the tragically early life expectancy, 38 to 41, that marred the country at the time. At some point in the 1880s, the area was coined by Dr. Aiken as Vishnu Springs, a relatively generic nod to the supposed healing nature of the waters. Another story of the origin of the name is that Ebenezer's son, Darius, an important character later, had read a book that described the discovery of the ancient preserved city of Angkor in Cambodia. The water of the city was fed by the river Krishna, which is the incarnation of Vishnu in the Hindu religion. There is no solid confirmation who named the place, Darius or Dr. Aiken, but either way, it was known as Vishnu Springs. No resort existed at this time. Dr. Aiken was more interested in selling the water. He marketed it as a solution to inflammation of the kidneys, as a cure-all to diseases specific to women, and a multitude of other ailments. He sold the water for 25 cents a gallon, but not nearly the amount that he would have liked. At this time, for reasons unconfirmed and undocumented, Aiken's association with the springs ended. It is documented that Ebenezer Hicks was committed to an insane asylum at some point during the 1880s, leaving Darius Hicks in charge of Aiken's parcels of land. Darius Hicks, inspired by the healing nature of the springs, saw potential. he decided to take the first steps in creating a permanent resort town there. It's up for debate whether Hicks was a true believer in the healing properties of the water, or simply one of many showmen eager to capitalize on anything remotely unusual at the dawn of the 20th century. I personally suspect the latter. Either way, he was met with success. He sold plots of land surrounding the stream for $30, roughly $1,000 today. In the middle of his resort town, he, among many other individuals, conceptualized and constructed a hotel named the Capitol Hotel. The hotel's construction notably attracted a holiness camp meeting of about 3,000 individuals from Higher Township. They came to not only witness the construction of the hotel, but to share in the experience of their religious beliefs and to try the water. It is believed that this may have kickstarted the interest in the town. Word of mouth by the members of that camp meeting, along with a variety of other interlopers. Reaching the town was difficult, so Hicks and two other proprietors, brothers John and Milton Morning, started the Vishnu Transfer Line. The line was accessed in nearby town Colchester. For 75 cents, a family could ride a spring wagon, meal included, through the woods to the town. If you paid a dollar, you could enjoy a more luxurious ride, a carriage or canopy-topped buckboard. For the day, the Capitol Hotel was lavish. It featured a blacksmith, a post office, a restaurant, and later, the surrounding grounds established a schoolhouse, a racetrack, a fishing pond, and parks. A photograph gallery was opened. The hotel built a grand organ, and musicians from Illinois were attracted to the hotel to perform for the residents. These concerts were met with great enthusiasm. Things ran neatly and were met with enthusiasm for many years. The variety of entertainment, along with the well-run facilities, were taken advantage of by those who could afford to do so. Such was the norm for a long time. But in 1903, a recently established carousel was functioning as expected, children atop real horses traveling in a slow, neat circle. The carousel was manned by an attendant that somehow got his shirt sleeve caught in the mechanism that regulates the speed and course at which the horses traveled. He got hopelessly crushed in the gears and died very slowly. This incident was met by total chaos and the screams of dozens of children, and the carousel never again ran. It was reportedly dismantled the same summer. An incident of this nature is bound to cast a gray light on not only any place, but doubly so a resort town built surrounded by the allure that traveling there will extend your life expectancy and cure you of any ailment. With the town infused with the dark flavor of death, the waters felt poisoned. This, in combination with a difficult and arduous trail needed to access the town, especially during the winter, Vishnu Springs began its gradual decline. Later that year, Darius Hicks abandoned the town himself, never to return again, eventually shooting himself in the head in 1908 after a chain of life events that resulted in a break with reality. The management in charge of the resort simply stopped caring, which led to improperly run restaurants, defunct businesses, and a filthy hotel. By the 20s, nearly every business had closed, and the population, both permanent and transient, slowed to a trickle and disappeared. After the fact, there were sporadic attempts to revive the area. In 1935, a man named Ira Post attempted to revive the resort. He decided not to market it as a healing spa, but a picnic and resort area. It had limited success, but in 1950, Post died and his legacy was not maintained. In 1968, a couple tried to market the resort town as a country music venue and restaurant, which was met with swift failure. In 1970, students from Western Illinois University started a commune there. This was the most successful post-resort spa effort to date. The commune was surprisingly self-sustained and contained livestock, copious farming, and music festivals. In the early 1980s, the hotel was once again abandoned. Today, most of the town is completely gone, be it by vandals or the elements. However, the hotel still stands. While it is a shell of what it used to be, it still has a stately way about it, and there are rumors of ghosts. I will not touch on those, so take them as what you will. In 2003, the former resort was donated to Western Illinois University as a wildlife refuge and a place for conservation and research. Visits are encouraged, but visitors are expected to treat the place with respect and to expect a long trek to get there, nearly a mile through dense, dark woods. I'd like to close our story with a rumor. To add a hint of glamour, it is reported that Hicks filled the streams with hundreds of goldfish near the conception of the resort. In the early 1980s, close to the true abandonment of the resort as a business venture, many claimed that they saw the gold flicker of fins just beneath the surface of the water. Maybe it was sunlight, but I choose to believe they were goldfish old and new, surviving alongside the pulse and flux of human presence over the course of 100 years.
This has been Unknown America on 90.7 FM, WGXC, Accra. Haley Palumbo, signing off.